And when we went into the station break, David, I was talking about the fact that once the Israelis exited Lebanon and abandoned southern Lebanon, once the Intifada kicked in, now we're looking at the situation of missile attacks being lobbed into northern Israel. It's deja vu all over again. But when we talk about occupation here and security there, no one seems to take recognition of this very serious lesson.
Well, you see, now that is, when you talk about the occupation of Lebanon by Syria, my church in particular, the United Church of Christ, has remained silent about this issue. And for the most part, mainline Protestants have. And a while back, I wrote a piece about this issue. Why the silence about the Syrian occupation of Lebanon and all of the complaints about the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza? And ultimately what you see is that the Protestants in the United States have pulled out a narrative from the Palestinian Christians and held it up as an emblem for everything that is wrong about the Arab-Israeli conflict. And so the one group that publicly condemns the Jewish state for its suffering is the one group that mainline Protestants have said they want to champion for. But they have said nothing about Christian efforts and the Christian role, or the role of Christians in Lebanon to help free their country from Syrian occupation. They have said nothing about the suffering of Coptic Christians in Egypt, and they have said nothing about, you know, up until very recently, they said very little, if anything at all, about the genocide against Christians and animists in Sudan by, you know, what can only be described as a Taliban-like government in Khartoum. And ultimately, you know, it really raises a lot of questions. You know, why are we, you know, why are we picking up the narrative from the one group that basically blames the Jews for its suffering, but have said very little about other Christian groups throughout the Middle East that have a huge problem with Islamic jihad being fought against them? You know, the whole issue of Quranic law or Sharia being imposed on them, the whole issue of dimitude, you know, these are issues that mainline Protestant churches have said very little about. And it, ultimately what it does is that it undermines people's confidence that these churches are worthy of the benefit of the doubt.
You know, the mainline churches had a number of issues. Number one, they began to drift from their belief in the inerrancy of the scriptures, slipped in what at one point was called a modernist theology.
The views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Well, good evening, and welcome to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show this last Wednesday evening of June 2005. And as we conclude our series, The War on Reason, This will be our seventh and eighth hour on the series that has taken us across the spectrum to look at what it is that is ailing our nation and ailing the world at this point in time. And we've seen that in our own country, we've begun as a government to examine the contents of our children's minds. Well, there's something, a deep conflict with that idea and the notions that we're going to talk about this evening. And we've talked somewhat and certainly have seen the same Congress that's imposing those rules upon us are also engaging in regionalistic so-called phony free trade across the globe while breaking down our barriers and destroying our boundaries and ruining our national sovereignty. And you watch us as we fight an undeclared war in the name of a permanent revolution. And just in this last week, we've seen one case in the Supreme Court that shocks most of America, but that case is really just the fruit of a case that was decided only at the end of May, 30 days ago, when the United States Supreme Court unanimously decreed, in effect, that the American economy was no longer based on private property, but instead it was based upon public-private partnerships. Now, that case is called Lingle versus Chevron, and it was a unanimous case. Liberals and conservatives agreed on that shift. We watch our society as we begin to develop a sustainable police state where crises are created to cause shortage. That shortage is either real or imagined, but the shortage exists in order to help cause an even greater crisis. Well, the question is this, as we conclude our series on the all-out war on natural law, the questions rise. Why has society lost its parenthood, private property, and individual liberty? What is natural law? How has positive law and legal positivism been allowed to trample natural law? And what would that mean for the future of the human race? Tonight we're going to hear from a dear friend whom I only know over the telephone, Mr. William Roberts, as he explains historical developments and the transformational doctrines that have mired America into a worsening condition. When we understand that disease, we can together cure the illness. So, let's begin to launch into a talk that no college teaches these days. Will, are you with us?
I am, Michael, and thank you for the opportunity to join you on air again this evening.
I'm looking forward to it, and I'm sure our audience is eager to hear. And I just want to give a rough thumbnail of what I understand, and you can correct me if I'm misguided. But to advance the audience on what we're going to discuss tonight, it's that we're going to discuss legal positivism or positive law, and we're going to talk about natural law, and contrast those dynamics. While you trace for us the historical developments in law, religion, and philosophy that lead to the dichotomy between the two. And then we're going to talk about how we're standing at the verge of what is a new world. We'll be right back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio. We're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Station. While some stations leave us for a few minutes, we're going to begin our discussion with Will Roberts. And Will, have I outlined where this conversation is going to go tonight?
Yes, you have, Michael. I think the best way to begin is to restate what we said in the beginning of our previous broadcast back in May, and that is there's a premise that I've been working on, trying to come to a higher understanding of it, and the premise is stated simply as this, that there is an all-out war raging between legal positivism and the natural law. And looking at that particular premise, that all-out war raging implies that there is going to be a victor and that there will be a vanquished. And that this is raging, and that this is not a light battle. And it's between the aggressor, legal positivism, and the victim here, or the natural law. And the natural law is a very, very old concept that is often misunderstood, But legal positivism is a relatively new invention. Positivism is as old as the natural law, and the positive law is its partner. But if, as we look at this, we could style tonight's broadcast as Beyond the Scientific Revolution, which was the point we arrived upon at, in the last broadcast, and in this one, the counter-revolution of the new legal order. And I'd start with a quote from Heinrich Rahman, and he said in 1930 that our modern dictators are masters of legality. Hitler aimed not at a revolution, but at a grasp of power according to formal democratic processes, which he styled Adolf Legality. And that's the ultimate in legal positivism, whereas if you'll recall, we said that whatever the prince says has the force of law. It's not law, but it has the force of law simply because it was desired by or stated by the prince. Now, in our previous broadcast, we went into depth into the idea of the positive philosophy of the French philosopher Auguste Comte, and we considered the social climate, which was the age of revolution, that fostered Comte's desire for universal, conservative, and stable governmental organization, which if you look at those, that sounds like a good deal. Who wouldn't want it? Which gave meaning and purpose to his life, but it energized his theoretical form of social control, which was intended to render anarchy, disorder, and contention.
Hold that thought.
Impossible.
We'll be right back.
We're here with our guest tonight, Mr. William Roberts from Missouri, Will from Missouri, as he's often known. And we're discussing the, Will's given a brief review of the May discussion we had here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio, where Auguste Comte was discussed in the context of positivism and legal positivism. Will, let's continue with your discussion.
Very good. We found that through his encyclopedic analysis of social development, Comte concluded that all the societies in history progressed through identifiable stages of development, which he classed under two primary heads, the first being the theological stage and the second being the metaphysical stage, and he visioned a third stage, though yet unrealized, which is the positive stage. And Auguste Comte was a schooled mathematician. He went to school at the École Polytechnique in Paris. And he developed his mental construct much in the same way as an architect designs a building or an engineer would build a bridge. The first thing that he did was he developed a course or a system of positive philosophy, the conceptual foundation of his positivist social organization, and the historical, scientific, and logical proofs demonstrative of its validity, its utility, and its necessity as an institution. So rising from that footing then, Comte set forth his system of positive politics, advancing as his ideal a polity or a form of government that was led by an appointed dictator, selected by the very elite, which he styled the patriciate, that's a throwback to Rome, guided by a class of super social workers, which he called or styled the priesthood, and the remaining body of man was simply left in the pile called the proletariat.
Well, and I relate to that in today's terms, hearing NPR broadcast talking about the choice we have as to whether, in order to be free, this story went, we could choose between being beekeepers or bee workers. It sounds very strangely like what you've just communicated to us, brought up about 170 years forward.
Well, it would be a whole lot easier if Bush was a dictator.
Well...
Comte's positivist philosophy admits only that which can be in fact or principle verified, and that is absolutely important to remember because it is going to render obsolete speculation regarding supernatural first causes and final ends, though he does allow for the intercalation of concepts and ideas where science senses the necessity yet has not discovered the identity, such as Mendelssohn's incredibly intelligent idea of leaving blank spaces in the periodic table of elements pending future discovery. And Darwin's specious evolution theory, the origin of species, relies heavily upon this Comtean intercalation concept to fill the many colander-like holes in their pseudoscientific search for missing leaks and geologic proofs.
Wow. You know, that's also interesting because in earlier broadcasts in this series, we've talked about the Fabian political machine, and some of these people who are you're identifying here, Darwin, and I know I've heard you talk about Dewey in this context,
right,
as positivists, were also Fabians. So we can see how these ideas really root an evolutionary process that has been politicized and brought us up to today's world where, this concept I see in land use all the time, where rules must be followed, best management practices must be followed, and the concept of trial and error, that which really brings improvement because it relies upon human potential, is simply nubbed and can't be done under the new rules. So we're seeing even the Endangered Species Act as a direct model, it seems to me, of what it is you're talking about, rooted in this Comtean notion.
That's right, Michael. And the concept of trial and error, of course, is not empirical, even though scientists use it, but it is not in principle verifiable. And so, but nevertheless, trial and error can produce verifiable results. But in addition to this that Comte has set up, his system of philosophy, which you can style with you could put a toothbrush mustache and a swastika armband on it and call it fascism. You could dress it up in plaids or tweeds and you could call it Fabian socialism. You could put a red jacket on it and call it communism. Positivism, I believe, runs right at the heart of all of it because it sets up this system for absolute control of society. And thinking through his program, he also, like many men before him, he sought to relieve man of his superstitious and religious inclinations, and he resolved the problem of religion by offering one of his own design, which he called the Catechism of Positivism, or the Summary Exposition of the Universal Religion, which he set forth in 13 systematic conversations between a woman and a priest of humanity. Under this, and all successful group or movements have slogans, and here are some of the slogans that he put together: Republic of the West, Order and Progress, Live for Others, whereby humanity would live with love for principle, order for basis, and progress for end. Comte desired to redirect man's innate yearning for intimate, enhanced personal relationship with the creator of the universe away from what he felt was an unknowable God or a system of gods, and invented, established, and maintained by an exclusive self-serving priesthood, instead focusing on his theory of the great being, humanity. Now, wherever we hear in Comte's work, the great being or humanity, the great being is all caps, humanity is a capitalized word, but humanity basically means the family, the country, and humanity, which is the whole of all people. So, in his idea, the supreme being or the great being begins with the family, then the country, and then all of humanity. And he was a humanitarian. In this, his whole process focuses on his ideas of altruism, which is live for others, phenomenology, which identifies various aspects of life as phenomena, and again, the humanitarianism. But in his positivist system, and we can look for a minute here at his idea of religion, in his positivist system, women are set free from the bondage of wage labor, prostitution, and servile labor outside the home, which had been their miserable circumstances under both the feudal system and the then rapidly expanding capitalist industrial revolution. Women and children were worked just grindingly and lived in horrible circumstances, like little cubicles in Manchester, England, and some of the other places where they would have a textile mill. They would work from extreme hours all day, all night. In capitalism has to have that machine running for as many hours a day as it possibly can. And it was the people that were taking the brunt of it. And what Comte saw was that the education and the care of the children would become the domain of the women as their highest calling, together with the ordering of the family home. And thus, the disinterested public education and child labor would be abolished. So that's just one aspect of his enormous religion that he built. And in that instance, in that particular instance, you can see how he is thinking about others. It's kind of an altruist side.
Well,
go ahead.
No one could certainly argue with the ideas about the women and children, the concerns he had, and the righteousness of the solution. Mothers and families. Natural law advocates. Certainly support that notion. Individualist mentalities certainly support that notion, and a healthy society certainly exists because of that situation. So there's much about positivism that is compatible with the human spirit and the human nature.
Exactly. And that part of the seductivity or the seduction of the system it finds its root there. And you can see today where we're starting to have a problem with our education system. It's about 50 to 70 years old now, but in this same situation, now we're starting to hear more and more about homeschooling as an alternative, a viable alternative. It doesn't relieve the double taxation where the families that homeschool still have to pay for the public schools, but it could very well be welling up out of the roots that were started in the 1850s by Auguste Comte and his desire to have women teaching the children and keeping them at home until their middle years. So Comte also proposed and designed a calendar for use in this new positivist West, one that would call to memory every month and each day the greatest men in history. And in fact, his whole plan was founded upon the principles of altruism, humanitarianism, phenomenology, and embraced within his new science, he coined the term sociology. And it's from sociology and the social sciences today that we can say that we have come now to a place where we are moving into this new world order. And as Aldous Huxley wrote his Brave New World, styled after Auguste Comte's work, we can see that it's coming to pass, and it's coming to pass today. So let's jump back now and look at this, our original premise again, because we're going to turn now from talking too much about positivism and Comte, and we're going to look at the other part. We have already talked about positivism. Let's look at the natural law. And the natural law, just like legal positivism has two terms, so does the natural law. Now, law, anybody can just grab their dictionaries and look them up. Basically, it's a regime. It's a system. But the natural law has two definitions in itself. And we'll take a look into them deeper. But as we discovered previously, with both of these terms, words have meanings, and meanings are important, and we must learn our terms.
That is so very critical. And would you surmise, we've certainly had others on this radio show who talk about whether the terms are being defined or even presented in our school system. You having a thought on that? Issue?
Yes. I hear the music coming. Should we just go with it?
Well, we've got about 15 seconds.
So. All right. The idea of changing the meanings of words comes out of logical positivism, and we are also losing our touch with reality in the philosophers, and the whole reorganization of the mind can be done by changing the vocabulary.
We'll be right back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show with our special guest, Will Roberts. Well, while some stations take a break, we're going to continue in our conversation with Will. That's a very powerful statement you left us with as the segment expired. Explain it a little bit.
Okay. There are two common definitions of the natural law, but I'm going to stand on the first definition as being the definition that is truly valid. And in that definition, it can be isolated, and it can be empirically proven that there are certain laws that define the operative nature, the operative functions of nature, and these are known collectively as the laws of nature. And take, for instance, if you were to accidentally or inadvertently knock a coffee cup off the table, when you first brush it with your hand, the action and reaction between the hand and the coffee cup is a demonstration of equal and opposite reaction. As the coffee cup leaves the table and starts to head for the deck, it goes through the process of defining the natural law of gravity. And if you carefully swept it up and weighed the coffee cup before and after, you'd have a reasonable demonstration for the law of the indestructibility of matter. And following this line of reasoning, and initially considering man in the absurdity of being an individual apart from the rest of society, but looking at him individually, we find certain natural laws that define his existence. And I've just whipped these together. This is not an absolute list, but just go with it. I think it gives enough for what we need. Man breathes, and that's air. Man drinks, water. Man moves. Motion is essential for digestion, circulation. Man eats, food. Man excretes, waste elimination. Man procreates, has both the potentiality and the actuality. Man senses, the see, the hear, the taste, the smell, the touch. Man thinks, man vocalizes or speaks. And insofar as these attributes are the very essence of being physically man, they constitute a body of inalienable, immutable, natural law by which man exists. Physical defect, deformity, or injury notwithstanding, these attributes are manifest in man as naturally as that water flows downhill. And nowhere in history that I can find has a tyrant or a despot long endured that sought to restrict or prohibit man's free exercise of these natural law attributes.
Well, we certainly have a very powerful movement in this country, in this county, and across the world to collectivize water resources between government and its corporate partners. And that goes and cuts right to what we're talking about here, it strikes me, because the idea that man, ordinary man, citizen man, cannot make his own access to water in a individual context or in a town's context, that all the water is now being formulated under new water laws in every state in the country, under manufactured crisis in every state in the country. Our water is being collectivized and arranged through government water districts and through global multinational for-profit water companies working actually together to meet World Bank water policies, leaving us with that basic ingredient now subject to the control of a very narrow and narrowing elite, which would be a very dangerous condition, would it not, for the natural law?
Well, Mario Soros in the Green Cross Optimist magazine, in his article, The Right to Water for All.
Now, people who don't know what that is, the Green Cross is Mikhail Gorbachev's organization.
That's exactly right. It comes out of Switzerland, and you couldn't get much closer to the source.
Excuse me for letting that run over you, Will. We're with our guest, Will Roberts, here on the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show, and we're discussing the natural law and how it gets the basic essence of what human beings need in order to have a life of their own, and have a life, period, including the right to drink and, drink and procreate, to excrete, to use the senses, to think, to vocalize, to
eat. I've stated to Michael in a very positive, direct way, without any ambiguity, man breathes, man drinks, man moves, man eats, man excretes, man procreates, man senses, man thinks, man vocalizes. These are the natural law attributes of man, and when you take them away, the very essence of being physically man evaporates. And in Mario Soros' article here, he says, the transfer of control over the world's water resource to such water kings as Suez, RWE, Thames Water, Vivendi, and Bechtel through the privatization of service provision and Nestle, Coca-Cola, Danone, etc. through merchandising is becoming the order of the day. The new legal order is seeking to take away the right, the natural law that says man drinks. And so that's what part of this all-out war that's raging.
Well, and this all-out war is everywhere. Here in our little county of Santa Cruz, RWE owns one of the small towns' water systems. The county, though, is putting together a consolidated program to consolidate all water districts in this and several counties that surround, all as part of the Gail Norton public-private partnership for American waters that's to take place across the country. And so what the voters up there get is a pit. They can have RWE, which is an Agenda 21 water company, or they can get the County of Santa Cruz working with other sustainable development Agenda 21 counties in this Northern California area. And either way, we end up with our water policy subject to centralization rules on a global level that take away human beings' capacity for the access of their own water.
Well, fortunately, as I mentioned previously, I've never found a tyrant or a despot that long endured that sought to restrict or prohibit man's free exercise of these natural law attributes, which gives them not just their enduring nature, but that sets them, in my opinion, as sacrosanct or immutable or inalienable, as we previously stated. And out of all of the creation, particularly mammals, man also has demonstrated a need to accessorize more pronounced than any other. And you could take any example, but like a bear with its long claws for digging and a den for winter, or the beaver with its chisel-like teeth, a lodge and a dam for a pond, man has none of these, but by design has the mental capacity to observe, visualize, then create accessories to improve the quality of and extend the length of his life.
Well, that really gets to be the key. I mean, the functions you talked about earlier all give man the capacity and the reason to create.
That is correct.
And so am I understanding you to say that the natural law, for it to be adhered with, has to give each person the room to lead the life that allows them to create
natural
potential?
Yeah, the natural law, the way I've defined it here in this first way, is it just basically sets up the conditions which are his very essence of human being. And from those that I previously gave, from the natural extension then of man thinks, man senses, and man moves, we could advance, we might add to our list, that man creates. And that concept of personal property is prehistoric. Anybody who's ever napped a blade from stone or forged one out of iron, I know not many people do that anymore, but I play with it. Anyone who's ever woven a basket or made clothing, broken a horse, raised up a calf, built or furnished a home, tilled and harvested a field of grain, we don't need to have any reminder of the joy of producing and the wisdom of retaining that which we've produced for our personal consumption, barter, or trade. And from these extensions of man creates, we arrive at a fundamental threshold, and this is really where we need to be at, a fundamental threshold between the objective natural law and the subjective positive law, by advancing the hypothesis that what man creates is his to keep.
It's a pretty basic notion. I'm beginning to wonder, though, how many people in America might have slipped into a failure to understand that.
It's probably a very large percentage, and mostly it's because of the obfuscation of terms that we get from our media, from our education, and from our peer groups.
Well, and that goes to what you summarized in the last segment, the idea that the capacity to manipulate man's consciousness exists, and as we find our society moving more and more rapidly toward a world of legal positivism, as we see the Supreme Court, as it did last week, rule that government, because it wants increased tax monies, can take your home or your business and give it to a friend of the government, a compliant, sustainable developer, smart group developer, changing your life and those around you forever. We'll be right back. We're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show with our guest, Will Roberts, and let's just continue while some of our stations are away for a couple minutes.
All right. Herein lies the mystery, however, between this war between legal positivism and the natural law. For as you might recall from our previous broadcast, Michael, we advanced the simplified definition of legal positivism as whatever the prince wills has the force of law. And will is the driving force behind positivism, and reason, or some say reasonableness, the product of the intellect, is the driving force behind the natural law.
Well, it's force against peace.
Yes, it is. A nation, all men against each other at war versus all men moving towards peace. It's the will that gets you on at a job site, and it propels you towards the end of the day and the end of the project, but it's the intellect that provides the means to that end. And this conflict is defined by an unreasonable force of law, which I know as the color of law, locked in a mortal combat against the reasoned rule of law, or the natural law, the inalienable, the immutable, the eternal laws of creation, and in a government by raw power versus government by the consent of the governed.
Well, we've talked before about how the dynamic between the American ideal of government and the globalist United Nations dictates for government stand in exact contrast and exactly on that point, because the UN Declaration contends that the freedoms granted, in essence, by the Declaration would always be subject to the principles and policies of the United Nations. That centralized force operating itself as the ruling edict maker for a global world dynamic where natural law is gone. Is that a fair statement?
Well, I wouldn't say that it's gone, but it is certainly going through a process of redefinition. But both the will and the reason are natural attributes of man. You could even add them to the natural law list that we put up above, that man wills and man reasons. But it's the despotism of absolutist and totalitarian centralized government which provides the spark or the impetus. Whenever the government becomes really oppressive, that's when the natural law or the state of nature revives. It comes back up and it starts to bite the totalitarian right where they don't want it. And what it is, basically, it's creation seeking harmony or a balance between the positive and the common, or the neutral or the natural ground. It's like an electrical circuit that is trying to overcome a short circuit that's in the system.
We're going
to
bring our audience back here, Will, so hang that thought for a second. We're back at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio, and we're continuing our discussion on the natural law with our guest, Will Roberts.
Thank you, Michael. We have that concept there, then, between the reason and will. And the reason and an unreasonable overuse of will, which results then into this totalitarian form of government. But all the so-called philosophies of law and practically all the social theories of the development of law, of the human personality and of property, are clouded when we assume that man's laws have always been directed by men capable of reasoning. In the beginning, instinct ruled, and ruled very strongly. And that chiefest of those instincts is the idea of self-preservation. And even today, man's instincts subvert and render void the most reasoned and flawless and elaborate systems of law. And we must remember that in this particular all-out war that's raging, we have those people who have long endured in positions of grandeur and power and control, and they have just as absolutely strong a desire and an instinct to remain, you know, to self-preserve, as does everyone else on the planet. So it is going to be, I perceive, an all-out ruckus as we come to some more common and more harmonious life. And guided by instinct, sociable man found that the natural law, right where he was, let me say that again, I misspoke, guided by instinct, sociable man, now man is sociable and sociable man are a little bit different, but sociable man found the natural law right where he was. He didn't come along and find it written on a rock or on the side of a tree. He discovers it out of his customs and his traditions as he lives, as he discovers his breathing process and all of that. And Quigley and Comte, Aquinas and Aristotle have all written that only after the necessities of life are available in abundance can sufficient leisure exist to afford the contemplative nature of man to turn its attention upon science and philosophy. And so unless there is a situation or a place in society where a certain class of people have gotten enough leisure to sit down, in other words, your head down, your elbows flying, your hoe in the beans, a man in that position hasn't much time for philosophy, politics, and religion. But when we have a society such as we have in America today, where more and more and more people, higher and higher percentages of people, have the time to think on these subjects, perhaps all of us together will be able to come up with the correct approach to resolve the problems that we're facing today.
Well, but it's certainly the case. I think of many examples that come to mind, the more recent, the more, of people getting out of school with PhDs who have no sense of any of these ideas, with people, it seems to me, who are being taken and given the higher roles in upper education, are people who have no sense of these ideas and increasingly show no interest to these ideas. So this crop of philosophers you're talking about need to follow the path that you have until our universities are not logical positives themselves. It is little hope for the young person to survive the kind of indoctrination that is increasingly obvious on our university campuses.
Well, I would agree with that, and it starts not just at the university campus, but it starts at the preschool, the daycare, the preschool, then in kindergarten, and it runs right straight up through the grades. It gets into the newspaper, the magazines, the radio, the AM, the FM. It goes full spectrum, the television set. Everything that we see, the products that we buy, we're programmed from cradle to grave, as the phrase goes, and we're being programmed away from these higher senses and the antiquity of thought, and we're being put into this now generation of material acquisition in the mommy state and the accessorization to the max, the cheap Chinese plastic items that will never feed you or support your life in any way, shape, or form. But at this point, let's go into this natural law now a little bit deeper. We had previously come up to a place for what I wanted to speak on the idea of shame. But let's just put that in our minds. We don't need to explain it. We're talking to an evening audience. Understand that shame is one of the most powerful forces that there is inside a system of government. Shame trumps force every time. But it was the Roman jurist Ulpian that set forth that the basis of natural law for human beings was the union of the male and the female, the procreation of children, and the protection and bringing up of the children. And we can then say that this was the making of the natural law positive. Are you with me?
Yes.
We know that we find the natural law in our existence, but when we make statements about it, we turn the natural law positive. There's no opposition between the natural law and positive law. Make that clear here, because it is the positive law that puts it into a system where it can be applied in the society. And we're going to look at three definitions here from Black's Dictionary. First one is natural law.
Well, let me maybe make an example. Tell me if I'm understanding it.
Go ahead.
Mobility, and in a modern world, mobility can mean moving faster than you can walk or run, say in a car. But a positive law with respect to our natural right to move and be mobile would imply that there be some rules of the road.
Right.
So the positive laws that are reflected in the rules of the road make sense.
Yes, that's right. And we'll see. That'll become perfectly clear right now. The physical law of nature, that's the first definition from Black's Law Dictionary, natural law. The first definition is that it is simply a physical law of nature, and that's what I'm positing. That's where I stand. The second definition they advance will give you a reason why we're going as far that we're going to go tonight, and the direction that we're going to take. The second definition is that the natural law is a philosophical system of legal and moral principles purportedly, keyword, deriving from a universalized, keyword, conception of human nature or divine justice rather than from the legislative or judicial action. Moral law embodied in principles of right and wrong. Now we contrast that immediately. That you could say, the natural law would be the priesthood. Give me that. Positive law. Here's the definition. A system.
But the definition you just gave of natural law sounds to me more like an example of logical positivism, because they've made a very blurred meaning there.
Well, you've got that exactly right, and that's what I mean when I say the obfuscation of terms. They've thrown in so much garbage and hoolypunk here that a person would be hard-pressed to understand what it was that they said.
Well, this is from Black's Law Dictionary, and I used a Black's Law Dictionary when I was in law school, but I'll tell you, there wasn't any real talk, even at this level, of natural law when you go to law school, and I can see why, if the definition for lawyers is blurred to begin with.
I would have to say that it is. Under positive law, Black's Dictionary states, a system of law promulgated and implemented within a particular political community by political superiors, as distinct from moral law or law existing in an ideal community or in some non-political community. And the second, it's kind of like a refrain, positive law typically consists of enacted law, the codes, the statutes, the regulations that are applied and enforced in the courts. And so here on the beginning in the natural law, we have man thinks, man breathes, man does these things. These are his natural law attributes. And the positive law brings that to codification, statutory, codified, privileged, licensable, taxable, revocable, and etc. But these are the laws that are made by man to enforce or give the natural law its legal standing. And this natural law, as I've put it, stands alone. It's the law of nature. Gravity is. Gravity remains immutable, regardless of where upon the earth it's observed. Truly natural law regarding man transcends both time and place. For as long as man, natural man exists, man breathes. So-called natural laws with purely customary or traditional origins are both time and place specific. And now, going back to Carol Quigley in his excellent book, The Evolution of Civilizations, he says in his book, and other writers have as well, Thomas Maxie Zane, that natural law rises out of customs and traditions of the society that the laws come out. So you could obfuscate what natural law is and say that, but I would prefer to just simply call a spade and say that out of our customs and traditions arise that body of law that we call positive law, and leave it at that and not try and make it the natural law. I believe that would be much more accurate and far easier for people to understand and grasp.
Okay, review that again.
Okay, that there are those, historians and legal people, who advance that law, the natural law, rises out of the customs and traditions of the societies that man has, or the men are in. And so we say that the natural law is that that's mine over here, and this is the way we deal with it, and if you take it, you get 6 years or fine $350. And so that whole body there is one aspect. But on the other side, there's this basic and fundamental, like a drone, like a hum, that stands there and says, man creates, and what man creates is his to keep. Now get your hands off. It's the end of the story. I don't need to go find a judge. I just need to look you in the eye. Because you know that, too. You feel the same way about your things. It can't be a natural law if it's person or place specific. It's immutable.
Well, I will never forget this case when I went down to downtown Santa Cruz. They were going to have a little rally that they called the Communist Party Rally, and I just kind of wanted to see what it was. There were only a few people there. But there was one fellow standing up on a knoll, and he was just indignant. He kept shouting, "Who took my pipe? Who took my pipe?" He was very possessive of his property that he obtained from some source.
It's natural. It's a natural feeling, and it's pretty difficult to separate it out from somebody. You can pontificate on it, but when it comes down to the brass tacks, we pretty much all feel that way. Now, the positive tool, or the positive law, is a tool. I have much of this is written out, and I'm reading for it, so when I misspeak, please forgive me. But the positive law is a tool devised by man. And as all tools have both a correct and an incorrect application, where the positive law is used, and these are my words, when the positive law is used to preserve, to clarify, or to protect the natural law, it's correctly applied. But when the positive law is used to confer the status of right to a natural law, abuse is sure to follow. Let's look at Black's Law Dictionary under right. It's a noun, and he said, number one, that which is proper under law, we've already seen that law is a regime, morality or ethics, something that is due to a person by just claim, legal guarantee, or moral principle, a power, a privilege, an immunity, secured to a person by law, not by nature, or nature's God, by law, a legally enforceable claim that another will do or will not do a given act, a recognized and protected interest, the violation of which is a wrong or a breach of duty. So this concept of right, then, is completely different from the natural law. The natural law is as pure as your skin. When you add something like a natural right, then you invoke the entire legal order. This whole establishment comes on board. And that's why I think that we need to draw a line here and stand upon the natural law as being a law, the laws of nature and of nature's God, and this far no further. The legal order has been made encroachments into every area of our life, but upon this law, no further.
Well, that would roll back a whole lot of otherwise offensive laws that exist today that could not meet the standards that you so insightfully provided.
Well, through this constant battle for the upper hand between positivism and the natural law, we see that there, in the history and the development of law, there are places to begin and there are places to study. And many of these doors are being closed. As I mentioned on the previous broadcast, I went to a school library recently, and in the library there were no Plato, there was no Aristotle in the philosophy section. Primarily, it was Harry Potter and some shamanism and some other things, and how to feel great and my parachute and those sort of things. But there was no philosophy at a high school.
Well, this is the call to parents out there to wake up and to look around for curriculum that will really serve your child's interest in knowing and growing and seeking what is and contributing to themselves and to the society around them by bringing some fresh air to an increasingly polluted intellectual framework in this country.
That's right. And I can't think of any better place to start for understanding the natural law than to go back to the writings of Aristotle, because Aristotle was referred to by all of our predecessors, all of the founding fathers, all of the people between here and St. Thomas Aquinas. People just knew his writings. They were a treasure when they were rediscovered in the 1200s, and they should be on everybody's shelf, because even for casual reading, and they're certainly not heavy philosophy, even for casual reading, they teach on ethics and views and virtues and whatnot that have been extant since 380 thereabouts B.C., 335 B.C., where Aristotle set up his school in the Lyceum, and almost every branch of knowledge he treated upon. And when Auguste Comte went back and did his encyclopedic study, I can't help but to think that Auguste Comte was looking at the writings of Aristotle and saying, I'm going to have to do this. I have to go at least this far, or I'm going to miss it. And St. Thomas Aquinas looked back at the writings of Aristotle, and he tried to incorporate the Church's revelation into the philosophy of the day. And this understanding that when we go all the way back to the beginning and come forward through Sumer, up to Egypt, over to into Babylon, Sumer through to Jerusalem up to Greece to Rome over to Paris and to England and London, and then finally over to here. These ideas are so old and so base that if we forget them, if we don't make them part of our continuing study, we lose touch with our reality. I've heard many times that on the shortwave that people come out and they say that the Ten Commandments are the foundation of the natural law. But we need to remember here that the Septuagint, the Greek Septuagint, which is one of the oldest of the Hebrew scriptures that were ever translated into Greek, was made after Aristotle was already writing and was not likely made available to him during the time that he was writing. So we have much in the Hebrew writings that you can find in Aristotle's, and much in Aristotle's that you can find in the Hebrews. They're only 700 miles apart.
Mm-hmm. We're going to be back here very shortly at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio station. Before we do, let me say that up until the top of the hour, Will will be with us the second hour tonight. But up till the top of the hour, if you have a question or a clarification, give us a call at 888-24-LIBERTY. Or in Santa Cruz at 464-8295. We'll be right back to Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio. We're back, Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio, with our guest, Will Roberts. And let's just pick right up where you were.
Very good, Michael. The Ten Commandments of Exodus 20, 2 through 17, are different from those in Exodus 34 and 35. But generally, the followers of faith regard the former as being the Ten Commandments given to Moses by the Lord, whose name is Jealous, who is the sole object of human worship and does not tolerate the sins of man. But what I wanted to do is just touch lightly, because we're treating on legal positivism and the natural law, and show the difference here about trying to call the Ten Commandments as part of the natural law. Positive law, we can see that they certainly are, but as far as natural law, let's see if they line up. In Exodus 20, 4 through 5, God here prohibits carving and worship of carved items. Now, the penalty here is for violating this command imposes penalties upon future generations to the fourth degree. And natural law is held to be immutable. So any natural law would have to apply to every group, every tribe, every place on the planet Earth, and we find no tyrant or despot, living or dead, who has ever held those that are not party to an agreement liable to such an extreme extent. And so this would be a class of legal positivism. And with the
making you responsible for something you didn't do simply because it's the law.
Yes, that's right. You know, and we can appreciate the value of the document, but consider if you were driving to town and you were pulled over by an officer of the court and they wanted to see your driver license and you surrendered it to them. They come back, the officer's shaking his head. Son, I'm sorry. Your father was a bootlegger, boy. You're going to have to come with me. You know, your grandfather was a bootlegger. But, officer, I don't drink. I'm a teetotaler. I've never touched the stuff. But, son, your grandfather, you don't understand, was a bootlegger. You got to come with me. Now, that's only three generations back. You can imagine what kind of an upheaval we'd have in our life if our courts ran on this basis. But this particular section of the scripture there is what I consider to be the preamble or the enacting clause or the authority clause that leads into the Ten Commandments. And it establishes that the thou shalt and those things, these are commands. These are positive law, and if not positive law, then legal positivism. And what we're talking about is natural law. And so there's a distinction. Let me go on.
Then we're going to welcome our audiences back in about 20 seconds, so consider that as you proceed.
Okay. Then there are the seven Jewish Noahide laws regarding idolatry, blessing the divine name, murder, sexual transgressions, theft and civil law, court systems, eating a limb torn from a live animal.
And one more in a moment. Welcome back to Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. We're talking about the commandments and natural law and how they connect or disconnect.
Right. And so when we look then at the commandments and at the Noahide laws, we really have to ask ourselves, where in this is the natural law? And I think it would be best to understand, as the rabbis understand, that the Torah are considered the laws of Moses. And so we have the laws, we have the writings, and that we have the prophets. And so these laws are laws. These are the positive laws that were created by their community for their system, and they're not the natural law. They are basically positive law set up by them for their purposes. And let's go from there to metaphysics. Because if you recall, Auguste Comte had a very low opinion of the Catholico-metaphysical feudalism. And in the previous broadcast, you asked me, well, what was metaphysics? Well, I looked it up, and the term metaphysics was invented by one of the early editors of Aristotle's works to serve as a title for a group of the treatises which he placed after the section that he called the physics. So in the language, meta simply means after, and then there's physics. So, you know, it's not one of those ooh, you know, scary things. It's just simply that metaphysics relates to those items that were placed after the physics in his book. And those items are, first, philosophy, theology, or wisdom. And so his philosophy, that first philosophy on first causes, his theology, and then his wisdom make up the body of Aristotle's writing known as the metaphysics. And in those, we have a sure foundation for discovering the natural law as you read them. And I'm going to give you just a couple of examples. These are quotes from his writing. Aristotle, I'm going to start with just a couple easy ones from his Ethics. It says, "For man, therefore, the life according to reason is best and pleasantest, since reason, more than anything else, is man." So, where we said in the beginning that the natural law is the reason, and that positivism comes from the will, here he is saying that for man, therefore, the life according to reason is best and pleasantest. When we live according to the natural law, we are happiest, since reason more than anything else is man. So we could add to our list of natural law that man is reason. Here's another one.
Well, let me give this one. The state of nature, said John Locke, has a law of nature to govern it, which obligates everyone. And reason, which is that law, teaches all of mankind who will but consult it, that all being equal, meaning equal justice to all, and independent, that no one ought to harm another in his life, health, liberty, or possessions. But reason is the key, and that's the key to the natural law, and that's the key to what's ailing America today.
Well, part of this also defines a little bit of my process, Michael, in that when I start researching something, once you get on the idea, once you get the idea and you start going with it, you can follow. And as you get more time under your belt looking at and researching the history, then you start to catch these key words and these key phrases. And when you know that reason ties you right straight to Aristotle and the natural law and the other writers that came after him, it helps you to understand terms and philosophy and law so much better. Another one that he said, and this goes back to shame, "For these do not by nature obey the sense of shame, but only fear, and do not abstain from the bad acts because of their baseness, but through the fear of punishment. Living by passion, they pursue their own pleasure." So here's that sense of shame.
Coming right back. We're coming toward the end of our first hour on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. And I just want to remind our listeners, if you don't get this station for the next hour, we'll be on the archives tomorrow with this show. And we always have CDs available of our shows that you can order from us at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. Our phone number is 831-684-2232. And we'll be right back after station break.
Views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Well, welcome to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show tonight. We're here on our second hour with Mr. William Roberts, who lives in Missouri. And we're concluding our series with this hour. Our series is The War on Reason. And for those who got to hear the last hour, it built to a crescendo when it was easily deducible, as my production manager, Charlie Alvarez, pointed out to me during the moment's break here, that the deduction has occurred. The war on reason is the war on man. And with our guest, Will Roberts, let's return to our discussion on the war on natural law, which is the war on reason, which is the war on man. And with that, Will, we have some new audiences live. Let's just kind of pick up from where we were and continue the discussion that began with August Comte and moved into natural law and positive law, and contrasted natural law with legal positivism. And with that, welcome back, Will, for the second hour.
Thank you, Michael. And we can go right back to the very beginning and our premise, so that all of the audiences understand that what I'm working through here and what I'm sharing and what we are discovering in this is a premise that came to me, that there is an all-out war raging between legal positivism and natural law. And August Comte came to my knowledge through the study of the word positivism. And the natural law has been the focus of my study for the last month or two, or actually it's been quite a bit longer than that, but a very direct focus now for this broadcast. And we looked in the previous hour and brought us up to the time of Aristotle, who was the philosopher, and by many people's standard, he is could be considered the point of beginning for a study of the natural law. But there has been many, many writers, and there are many books out there, and it's not at all difficult. I recommend just going to Liberty Fund Books or any of the other books that are out there, book places, and pick up books on the natural law and get an idea for it, because we can't even begin to touch something that is 14,000 plus years old, at least, in my opinion.
And yet the natural law has, for long periods of time, been suppressed, and human beings have suffered as a result of that. The Dark Ages was the suppression of Aristotle's thoughts themselves.
That's correct. For over 1,000 years from Aristotle, after that, men that were possessed of an inquiring or a philosophic or a mathematical mind or a scientific mind had been under the threat of sudden death if by chance they were accused by the church of heresy. The priesthood had so basically eclipsed society that they were able to convict you on sight, virtually, of thought crimes. And so as a result of that, chemistry was advancing by fits and starts, hidden behind the alchemical promises of the transmutation of the base metals to noble. The medical arts were masked behind chants and incense, and astronomy, when spoken of, was couched in terms suited for merchants and soldiers, or spoken of not at all.
So that is what happens in a society that has suppressed reason, that has suppressed the natural law.
Absolutely correct, Michael.
Well, Will, I want to thank you. We're going to be right back here in a few minutes at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. If our listener has not yet seen Understanding Sustainable Development, Agenda 21, call us at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. We'll tell you the number in a moment. We're back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz with our guest, Will Roberts. And while some stations are away for commercial break, we're going to continue our conversation on the natural law and the war that is being waged against it. And in completing my thoughts on the guide, Understanding Sustainable Development, Agenda 21, this is the political action that is being used globally, and certainly by our federal government, Democrats and Republicans both, to bring America within this framework of a new world order of legal positivism and logical positivism, where the natural law is to be suppressed and where human beings are to become agents of state or community concern. So let's continue. And if you want to get that guide, you can call us at 831-684-2232
or check us out on the web at freedom21santacruz.net. And well, let's just continue.
Okay, Michael. The idea that the Dark Ages or the medieval period was totally dark is not quite correct, because there was continuing things that were going on, but largely the sciences were suppressed, and so the knowledge of the crafts and the trades was a carefully guarded secret. Hence the secret societies and the mysteries. A real great phrase I like a lot in Latin. It's ubi materia, ibi geometria, ibi mysteria, which translates roughly as that where there is matter, there is geometry. And where there is geometry, there is mystery. And Pythagoras and the others, they had basic knowledges. They started to come up with these sciences, as Auguste Comte put it in his philosophy, his system of positive philosophy. As each of these various things first comes through with the idea of numbers and mathematics, and to that we added the physics and astronomy and chemistry and chemistry to biology, they stack up. And so this idea, this ubi materia, ibi geometria, ibi mysteria, it begins at Pythagoras' mystery school or mystery religion. And the priesthoods often would glom on to these mysteries and hold them for themselves, and that the people would be left in the ignorance, but the priesthoods would continue the advance. And so we can thank the monks and whatnot for continuing the study of sciences. And when Thomas Aquinas in 1225 to 1274, who was considered the greatest of the theologians and philosophers of the Christian Church, when he's remembered as the angelic doctor, some people call him the Thomas, but when he came across, as a result of the Moors' invasion in Spain and conquest in Spain, when he came across the writings of Aristotle, it was like a door opening up, and this big lid that was down over the top of...
We're going to bring our audience right back, Will. Hang on.
Yeah.
Welcome back to Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. We're discussing the all-out war on natural law in our final hour on the series called The War on Reason. And we're discussing now the loss of Aristotelian thought during a long dark age period, and the dynamics, the political dynamics that expressed themselves during that time frame, as we begin to march up to the more current history of the natural law and its suppression or flourishing, I think.
Yes. And as these various writings from the Greeks and the previous centuries emerged, the period that was known as Scholasticism came about. And it was in that period that Thomas Aquinas was writing. And what he was doing with his writings was basically trying to get over the hurdle or the stigmatism that philosophy was a no-no. And what he did was he showed painstakingly and very carefully that philosophy was not in contradiction with religion and revealed knowledge. Now, it's very important, because revelation and philosophy, revelation and reason, were merged under St. Thomas Aquinas. And St. Thomas Aquinas became the authority that was first sought and last heard by both the Jesuit order and the Holy See for all doctrinal matters from his time all the way up until the schism that occurred under the General Council 31 and 32, when under Jesuit General, the Black Pope, Pedro Arrupe, the Jesuits sought, now here's a list of the things the Jesuits were seeking in those councils, the abolition of the Jesuits' fourth vow of special obedience to the Pope.
Now, wait a second, let me set the time frame for this, because this moved very quickly.
Yes, right.
From Aristotelian thought, which we discussed in the last hour, and in you're saying that the Aristotelian thought through Aquinas lasted until about 1970.
All the way up until 1970, they would look at the writings of St. Thomas Aquinas as the first thought and the final authority, or the first thought and the last heard, in all matters that had to do with their belief system. And so in 1970, when the General Council 31-32 met, the Jesuits in council sought the abolition of their fourth vow of special obedience to the Pope. That's a breaking with the Pope right there. They called for all-out support of socialist politics, the fomenting of revolutions in the third world countries, the embrace of communitarianism, the open support for homosexual marriage, divorce, and abortion, and premarital sex, the Hinduization of the Catholic theology, and much more. So that light that St. Thomas brought into Christianity through the incorporation of Aristotle's wisdom was extinguished after about 700 years by this black-robed army of Inigo Loyola in the 1970s.
Well, I must say that that when I was in grammar school, I heard a whole lot about Thomas Aquinas. But when I was in a Jesuit school from 1969 to 1974, including law school, I don't think I once heard of Thomas Aquinas.
Well, it's no surprise to me, because at that time the logical positivists were already exercising their will over education, and they were removing all of our thought about philosophy. And if you want philosophy today, you either have to go on the internet or do as I do, which is to go to the used bookstores and the flea markets and find these old books. Many of mine are hardbound editions from 1905, 1910, in that region. Now, the reason I bring that up is because we're coming to a really critical place here and understanding that there's something that's happening. There's a reason why I'm going. There's a method behind the madness. But let's go from Ignatius Loyola and the Jesuit order and the Vatican, the Second Vatican Council, and go right back down into Spain in 1492 with Christopher Columbus. When he discovered, what he really discovered, was the mastery of his own fear in 1492. The Jews were being expelled from Spain. He was coming out looking for other lands. But he was provided with maps by his brother Bartholomew. He was also provided with information by a man named Paolo Toscanelli, a learned man from Flores, that suggested that Colombo, to Colombo, his name is Cristobal Colombo, or Cristobal Colon, he called himself, many different names. But he was told, or it was suggested to him, that Japan lied just 300 nautical miles to the west of Lisbon. And so when Columbus came over, we call that the new world. He came to the new world. But what he discovered over here, and what the people that followed after him in his wake, was a treasure trove of gold and diamonds and land and labor and natural resources that was just like a plum, an oyster bed, something waiting just to be plucked and to be taken. And at that time in Europe, the system was such that access to large quantities of gold and silver just wasn't easily done. But the merchants and the men in the area could capitalize on this process. And also, there's always, we have to remember that there's piracy that lays in here, which piracy and plunder is one of the surest and fastest roads to wealth. If you can loot it, it's the quickest way. So London, Paris, and the other European centers, as soon as Spain started to really pop up, they wanted to get in on this enrichment and glory that was available just for the taking over in the New World. And we look at that and understand that there are many, many parts in history, and I have to go so fast tonight, but there are so many parts in history where there are valuable lessons to learn, but they have to be dug into, and you have to relate it to the place, to the space, to the time, and to the people to really understand all that you can know about it, and I certainly don't know either.
I think it's worth your sharing with the audience, Will, how you approach delving into a historical era. Because there are people, and young people and older people both, who are turning to the knowledge, to seek an understanding so that they can take it back out into society and help resurrect what's sagging in America today. How do you evaluate a period of time?
Well, basically, I find myself in periods of time following leads from other places, typically. But when I go back into a time of, let's just use Auguste Comte, and thinking about him and thinking about him writing, I have an encyclopedia collection that's growing, and I also have a large collection of books. And there's nothing expensive in any of this other than just adding up lots of 50-cent purchases and dollar purchases, because I buy all of my books out of boxes at farm sales and auctions and whatnot. But what I'm looking for, I drew basically a line in the sand about 1960, 1970. I'm not interested in the new books. I'll leave that to all of you with the internet and stuff like that. I'm going back before the sanitation process happened at the end of the free speech movement. So I go before the free speech
movement
in the 1960s, and I'm not interested too much in anything after that. So then I find this person, take August Comte in 1850, for instance, and I go into my encyclopedias and I lay out all the articles that talk about costumes and costumery, and I find my costumes. And then I go in and I look for all the stuff about horses and carriages and tack. Then I go and look at the architecture, and I'm really visualizing myself going right back until I can smell the horse manure, until I can feel the dampness in the room, when I can see the candle or the oil lamp, and then when I read the man's writings, I can understand his heart better, and it helps me to move myself right into his space and get the most out of what he's saying. And then that author will lead me other places. So I read one article or one book, and then I make notes, and all of the people that they reference as their mentors, as their inspirations, then I go out and I reach them. And as that works together, I've pulled together, and I've been through history so many times I get dizzy, but what I've found is there's this track, and we're coming to the place in this track that's critical for understanding, because I missed it every time I went through history. I missed this spot, and it's so, so very important. So, if we may, let's get down to that.
Okay, let's hear that spot.
All right, let's go back now and think in terms of Paris, 1512. In Paris, in 1512, there was a man whose name I have, but I don't have with me right at the moment, who started, some people say, started the Reformation. He was vocal, and he was a pamphleteer. But from there, we go to Geneva, Switzerland, and the person of Huldrych Zwingli. Now, Huldrych Zwingli was a Swiss reformer, and he said, they say, he led the Protestant Reformation in his country. Now, he was one of the first persons to object to the practices of the Roman Catholic Church and to demand reforms. That would be something that would get you deaf most days. But from 1516, Zwingli preached against fasting and the veneration of saints and insisted the priests should marry. But above all, he preached against the political power of the Pope, and that's so important. In 1523, he broke from the church, which of all the reformers, he's one of the few that did, and the following year married, and he died in a battle at Capel, fighting for his newly found religious beliefs. On October 31st, 1517, All Hallows' Eve, Halloween, All Saints' Eve, the Augustinian Catholic priest and reformer, professor of theology and law at Wittenberg, Germany, the great reformer and protester, Martin Luther, nailed his 95 theses to the door of the Wittenberg Church in Germany and symbolically crucified Christ afresh and drove a wooden hub right into the very heart of Christendom. And this began the age of sects, S-E-C-T-S, or that period that I call inventor religion, and it's the end of the old world order, and it crosses over the threshold into the age of protest, ushering in the Comtean metaphysical stage and a transition into the new world order. And even though these words are hard to deal with, and they may appear overly strong, their truth becomes evident as you continue to study through this. And without diminishing Zwingli's work in Geneva, the course that was set by Luther would split wide open the rotten gourd that the Catholic apostasy in Rome had become, and the disestablishment of the sovereignty of the Holy Roman Catholic Church. It was a transformation of the infallibility of the Pope into the hands of and the sovereignty of the people. It was the time of protest, the age of revolution. A house divided against itself cannot stand. The blood of Christ's elect began to run as deep as the horse's bridle, and it continues still.
Well, this time frame is, I've seen quotes from David Rockefeller himself.
Dating, I have that quote.
Yeah, dating the start of the New World Order at this point in time.
Absolutely.
And proclaiming that it's now 500 years later, and that's when it's to be completed. We'll be right back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. We're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio station. While some stations take a break, we'll continue our conversation with our guest, Will Roberts.
Well, here is that quote, David. It's David Rockefeller, former chairman of the CFR and COA, referring to NAFTA, the precursor to the FTAA, from a brochure that was put out by the Stop FTAA group. And the quote is, "Everything is in place after 500 years to build a true new world in the Western Hemisphere." And I just asked the audience to go back in your mind 500 years and see if we're not talking about 1517. And so the only thing that happened after 500 years is that when we go back there, we're looking at the Reformation. But into this gap, or I should start it over, that this looks like very strong words. And if we think about it, we'll see that there have been many of these kind of smoke screens brought forth in our life, where we see the collapse of the World Trade Center, for instance. But that's the time life remembrance of the time period. But there's something else that's happening behind it. And that's exactly where we're at with this one. Into the gap that was left by Zwingli and his successor, Bullinger, stepped John Calvin, a French religious reformer and the great theologian of the Reformation. Like Luther, he was a man of higher learning, schooled in both theology and law, groomed for the church from his youth. And he assembled his own Geneva Bible, just as Luther put together a New Testament. I don't recall whether he made the whole translation or not, but he definitely put together the New Testament in a language suitable for the people at the time in his area. And Calvin also wrote his Institutes for the Christian Religion, which he compiled while he was in Basel, Switzerland, and he built basically an idea of a church and a city government into a theocracy with the state subordinate to the church, in which all of the citizens had to subscribe to his articles of faith, and he brooked no opposition. He even had a man named Michael Servetus burned at the stake. So there's now we've got several people happening here. Down in Geneva, we've got Calvin, and up north in Wittenberg in Germany, we've got Luther. So we've got two parts of the puzzle. Then, if you go to the Dutch humanist Desiderius Erasmus, I stumble because his name is so unusual, Desiderius Erasmus, the Dutch Catholic scholar, who also never renounces Catholicism. If you look at Erasmus' life, as I've looked at it, I see him kind of, Michael, as Henry Kissinger of the Reformation. He knew, and he went all over the place, and he knew heads of state. He was a prolific writer of letters and corresponder, but he was welcome as a guest here or there. He traveled to the Rome, to the Vatican. He was over in England at Oxford, I believe, visiting with dignitaries and whatnot. And so he was kind of like the emissary of the Reformation. He stood a little bit at a distance from Luther, and he stood a little bit at a distance from Calvin, but he formed they formed a threesome. And here, with this threesome set up like this, plus the disestablishment of the Catholic Church that had already gone through the process of reorganization and reformation in England, now we're in a situation where we have the perfect condition for continuous unrest. We've got these triangles that we can play one off another after another, and we also then have the Jesuit army being built by Ignatius Loyola.
We'll come right back to that, Will, in just a moment as our stations return. Welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. We're discussing the period of the Reformation as the end of the old world and the discord that has fermented since then. And let's just continue on with the story.
Great. Well, we've got now that we've got this this opposition, this controlled opposition that's set up in this three-form triangle between Zwingli and between Luther and Calvin, Erasmus and the Anglican Church, with the Ignatius Loyola's Jesuit army. Now we can see that we've got a political system that has been set up very, very carefully. But laying right behind all of this, the private money and the masses backed the newly formed churches and emerging church groups. They were agitating for spiritual liberty while securing major advances in the means of production and the distribution of products. So the Catholic Church, with its vast land holdings in England and Europe, its ability to generate enormous wealth off of tithes, the control over both education and law, the Catholic Church, for the first time since its construction, its erection, was now actually in peril. And the ruling classes and major corporations were in danger of losing monopolies at home and abroad. Major quantities of gold were being dumped on the market. Parliaments began to appear as representative systems of government grew. There was an unlimited slave labor available in the West, and there was fertile soil free for the taking, just a few weeks' voyage to the west. And so this whole concept right here sets up an ideal place for conspiracy and intrigue that goes far deeper, in my opinion, than religion. And by splitting the church into first two, then four, then eight, 16, 32, 64, and so on, number of private interpretations, the church could be reduced to an absurd confusion, tolerated only against that far distant day when all of God's children would be petted against Islam and that the East would be brought to heel. So this three-in-one...
How do you make that statement?
Well, I make that statement because if you read the writings, for instance, of Albert Pike, where he proposes this concept of three wars, or if you read the booklets on a perpetual war for perpetual peace, or the report from Iron Mountain, but also if you just go back and look at the time and at the day, Islam, the Moors, the Mohammeds, had come in and very nearly taken Western Europe. And if you want to motivate people into war, the church provides the best motivation. If I were to just say that your boundary is in danger, well, we can all just agree that right now our boundary is in horrible danger, but there doesn't seem to be much motivation going on. But if you can bring it up to a jihad, you can get everybody out. You follow?
Yes.
So there's a strong incentive there because the theology and law lays back there with sociology. It lays back there and it can condition the mind. It's spaced repetition. You get it on Sunday, you get it on Wednesday. You get it on Friday night, you get it again on Sunday. And Monday and Wednesday and Friday and Monday and Wednesday and Friday. And the poor guys that are out there hoeing the beans, got their elbows down, they stumble into church on Sunday, they can hardly wait for a place to sit down, and they get the same message over again. So it provides a perfect vehicle for control. And I believe that control has always been one of the processes of the church. Going all the way back to the Bible, show you the positive law. Positive law has one purpose and one purpose alone, and it's control. And so we just bring it right straight forward. That's how I can make that statement.
All right.
Okay. So now we get to this point where we also need to understand that when Ignatius Loyola formed the Jesuit army, he had a cohort. His name was St. Francis Xavier. And Xavier split from Western Europe, went right straight to China, and began working it over there, starting to set up their network in the East India companies in China and whatnot, reinforcing this anti-Protestant feeling and maintaining and keeping alive the Catholicism that was already in place over there. When we go back and think about the Reformation, remember, there wasn't any other church in town. Up until these other fellows come along, there was one church. It was the one Holy Catholic and Apostolic Church, and everybody went there. And I think that's something that we forget today. There used to not be a choice.
Okay, well, where does that bring us today in terms of the natural law?
Well, if we take a look at the natural law then and see that we have people like St. Thomas Aquinas, Aristotle, Hobbes, and many others who have written these ideas up about the natural law. Hobbes wrote, "Nature has made men equal in their faculties of their body and their mind." And he talks about reason as the pace and the increase of science the way, the benefit of mankind the end, much like Comte's love, order, and progress. The natural law has always existed right there with man. And on the other side of that is the government imposing its control through law, but always religion has had theology and law as part of their domain and their dominion. And under sociology, the same thing happens. In the social sciences, you could take a course in political science, you could take a course in law, you could take a course in theology, etc. So I wanted to bring out some of the writings of Karl Marx, because he will bring us into the modern period right up till now, so that we can understand what's happening. But there is not enough time, so I'm going to be forced to and limit myself to one and one quote only from Karl Marx. In his book, Das Kapital, and I recommend it to anyone to read it, not so that you get the chance to rush out and become a communist, no, because the man studied, and he studied a lot. He was over at Oxford, he was in England, he studied and wrote. He wrote 2,200 pages in three volumes, Das Kapital. And it, just like Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, those books have a tremendous amount of true factual documented cross-referenced history. And he talks in Das Kapital, Karl Marx does, about what happened in England at a time that is very similar to what's happening today in America. And he said, here, I'll just give you the quote, then we talk about it. The process of a forcible expropriation of the people received in the 16th century a new and frightful impulse from the Reformation and from the consequent colossal spoliation of the church, the Catholic property. The Catholic Church was, at the time of the Reformation, the feudal proprietor of a great part of the English land. The estates of the church were to a large extent given away to rapacious royal favorites or sold at a nominal price to speculating farmers and citizens who drove out en masse the hereditary subtenants and threw their holdings into one, tacitly confiscated.
Well, we've had a lot of shows at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz about the Wildlands Project that's taking the farmers and the timber owners and the ranchers off the American landscape, and now we're seeing circumstances where rural inhabitants are facing increasing pressure, as are even suburban residents. You can expect that the prices of things are going to rise in an orchestrated way, and I'm talking about water and electricity and the basic necessities of life. Are going to shortages are being created, rules are being promulgated, and real suffering is being applied against the American people, all for the purpose of implementing positive laws like the Endangered Species Act and its soon to be birthed offspring, the Invasive Species Act. All of this is designed in order to create greater and greater pressure to create these corridors of open space that only the elite visit and that are now to be reserved for wild reintroduced animals. And real people are paying the price for that as we reorder our society in a way very similar to what you've described Karl Marx as having observed about England.
Well, what he was showing there was this idea that first happened in the conversion of the rural lands to sheep walks. The yeomanry, the people that lived on that land for years, centuries, had established farms, they had churches, they had towns, they had fences, they had systems. And after, I believe it was William the Orange came in, they basically appropriated the land, and they expropriated all those people from those areas, and they brought them down to Manchester, England, and other places where there were industrial centers growing. And they converted the men and women there and the children from freemen and yeomen and serfs and tenants. They brought them to the sustainable community of Manchester and other.
Smart growth, 1750 style. Relocation centers.
That is exactly right. By throwing them off the land, they had absolutely no means to their own care. They couldn't raise a farm. They couldn't raise crops. They were not able to any longer raise their own animals or grains or anything. They had no place to go, and they drifted. And they drifted down to Manchester, where they were basically used as humans in the process of industrial. So we've got spinning mills and things like that. Now, they could devise all kinds of new machines, but they still needed somebody to touch it here, then touch it here, then touch it here, then touch it here, and that's all a man would do, and he would do it for 14 hours a day. Or put a new spindle on, take a spindle off, put a new spindle on, take a spindle off. And so these people left behind their trades, their crafts, their farms, all of their history, and they came down, and some of them found themselves, like we said before, in prostitution, in all forms and manners of depravity, in abject illness, and a lot of them found themselves at the piers, and they were coming to the New World. They were ready to sign up. They would sign up for 10, 15 years of bondage just to get out of this hellhole and go someplace where they could breathe fresh air. Didn't care if they had to start from scratch and battle Indians. What they wanted to do was a chance to have a free start over again with a piece of ground where they could actually eke out a living. And we're going to be glad to have it when they got here. And when they did get here, the outward bounding of that sense of freedom and that sense of relief for all of this bondage and mental anguish that they'd had in Europe and in England, it just rebounded into this incredible society that we built in the first 150, 200 years of our nation. So the whole idea of rewilding is basically a corporate taking. and it's going to throw people into communities, sustainable communities, and into industrial situations and into feudal groups that they have no concept of whatsoever. And when we talk about it, Michael, I think it's so important that those that are listening pay attention and understand that this isn't hypothetical. It's coming.
Well, it's certainly being ordered up for us, and it is coming every time your local elected official allocates huge amounts of dollars or accepts huge amounts of dollars from the federal government for these New World Order infrastructure plans. I like to say it's the post-private property era infrastructure that we're building with all of these grants and nonprofits and inside developers while they take our homes sanctioned by the United States Supreme Court and take our businesses so the government can give over our houses and our property and our land either to wild animals or to wild animals under the name of the Nature Conservancy, a global corporation, or they give it over to the global water companies, if we're talking about water systems for your community, or they give over neighborhoods to an inside developer who will build the kind of housing that the New World Order government wants it to build. You know, America is falling fast, and it's doing it in the way that Nikita Khrushchev promised they would do it. They would do it without firing a shot. He said, "We'll bury you without firing a shot." And all of this is because we have lost contact with our basic. And as a result, there is a war on reason as children are separated from their parents and the children's minds are evaluated by government officials to make sure they have the right attitudes, values, and beliefs as Congress has passed this law that is causing that to happen beginning next year. Things are happening very quickly, but that's how it has to happen. They inch, and then boom, they have to pull the trigger. But it doesn't have to happen if people at local levels begin to get more involved and just say no to the community planning, the legal positivist community planning that's going on in every county in this country. You know, it's not that you have to choose this one or that one. You just don't engage in community planning. You just say no. You don't take federal money for implementing smart growth or sustainable development projects.
That's exactly right. When you put your hands out for grants and aid, federal grants and aid, you get the handcuffs put on. And so we need to learn to be independent and to not fall for these traps that seek to strip away the natural law that remove the very essence of being man. When Joan Vion wrote an excellent book, The United Nations Global Straitjacket, and she reported on a meeting that she went there with a man his name was Edison W. Dick, who was speaking, and this is what he said: more international law has been developed through the United Nations system during the past 50 years than in the previous history of mankind. The United Nations has been directly responsible for the conclusion of more than 465 multilateral agreements covering virtually every area of state interaction and human endeavor, from the law of the sea to narcotic drug control, from the environment to international trade and copyright law, from arms control to the advancement in women's rights. The development of international law to the extent that we know it today would not have been possible outside the framework of the United Nations. And so we can see that it's more than just a hypothesis, that there actually is an all-out war that is raging between the legal positivists and the natural law. And in this battle, the idea is that they will take the state, the rising state, the United Nations, will arrogate unto itself all of the natural law and then conditionalize, privileged, made statutory, codified, revocable, taxable, they eke out little glips here and a little bit here. And then we, the people, will have to try somehow to remain as human beings inside of this dynamic. The real problem here, I mean, there are many problems, they're obvious, but the real problem here is that this isn't local. If this was just my county, no problem. If this was just this state, less of a problem. If it was just in our nation, a real problem, but not impossible. Over the entire world, if this system is allowed to come into place, we will go into what I think to be a totalitarian, feudalistic society from which redress and relief may be exceedingly impossible. And this is what Auguste Comte was talking about and his plan that he laid out, when what he was showing was a system by which you would make anarchy absolutely impossible. You circle the entire globe. You circle all of the things that man is. You go to his schools. You set up that dynamic. You go through his legal system and set up that dynamic. You go through the process of the faith by creating a new, you know, we've all heard about it, the new one world order religion. You set up this new religion with a little box that they call something. Who knows what it is? Who knows what's in it? And who could care? But anyway, they set up a new religion. And then all of these things come together with the controlled media and a government that is not responding to the needs of the community or any rational development of the nation. They're being dictated to from Basel, Switzerland. They're being dictated to by NGOs. They're being dictated by all of these various groups and organizations. And as you've informed and educated me, all of these private-public partnerships that come up where they are corporatizing everything that we could think of, and where are the people? We're out of this mix. We're not in the loop. And I believe if there's anything that could be conceivably their downfall is because they're going too fast. They're not including the people, and they're not going to have any success in this because they're trying to go before, they're trying to pass a law before there is a condition that requires it. This is pure legal positivism. It is the will of this group. And I believe that because there are so many people now across America and around the world who are becoming aware of this paradigm, or whatever you want to call it, it's a lousy paradigm if you ask me, but this paradigm that is now coming on, as more and more people around the world, we saw it just now in France and in Holland saying no to the UN, we now have the benefit, even though it looks like a defect, of having the Supreme Court make such a heinous ruling against private property. Now we can, you know, basically attack and go into that area and show the positivistic nature of that. But as we, the people, learn to go into these meetings and to know that they're going to be anticipating us to say something goofy, and if we come in there and we've got our research together and we understand that they're going to try and marginalize us and try and attack us on social beliefs or on religion or on some other thing like that, if we just stick to the facts, bring it forward, and never stop, and that's the real key. It's like a deep well. You pour the water in to prime the pump, you grab hold of the handle, and you're just going to have to stand there and pump. And if you have to call a friend to keep pumping, do so. But if you stop pumping, you lose your prime, the water goes to the bottom, you got to start all over again, but now you don't have any water.
Well, the water is the right analogy. I can tell you that in this county, water is building to a real crescendo. The land grab, recently a habitat conservation plan that had been beaten back was sneakily put through and put on half the county. Programs for government housing along the railroad track are being funded with tens of millions of dollars regularly from the federal government. The farmers' land is under huge water taxation pressure. The forest owners can't cut their trees. It's coming from all directions. It's coming increasingly rapidly, and that is true. They're moving so fast because they know they don't have much time before people start to figure it out, and they're trying to get it in place beforehand. But their own ranks are going to begin to dissipate as they begin to see what is going to become and is becoming much more obvious, and that is that human beings are being ordinary human beings, even those who are social science workers, even those human beings are going to become collateralized as biological resources. Sure, they might be the beekeeper for a while as long as the ruling force finds use for them. But as we find ourselves moving into an enforcement phase of sustainable development, they'll have much less need for their planners and more need for the enforcement officers. So as the planners begin to see themselves, the mess that we're all in, that they're contributing to, certainly, many of them are going to have second thoughts, because it takes someone with a real cause for shame to want to undo humanity. to take away our human nature, which relies upon the protection of the natural law.
That's exactly right, Michael. And with this is one of the places that I think that we can see some real positive gain, is by remembering that we have an educational system, and that every single year we graduate out a new group. And each one of these new groups that comes out is further and further and further and further away from our origins. And so on the local level, an activation step that anyone can do is to put together more information from their own research on the natural law and on sustainable development, and go talk to the people who are teaching school, and go to the school teachers, and go talk to the people that are in school, like the college level, or particularly people who are taking the natural sciences, political science, sociology, urban planners, architects, and communicate this information to them so that they know that the information that they're given by their education system is at a disconnect with reality. And it's done so intentionally. It's done to their own hurt, because it will be their generation. I'm getting older. It's going to be their generation, the next, that are going to really suffer. And so we need to reach the young people that really are going to be impacted by this more so than I could fall tomorrow. But need to reach them and let them know that there is a time now that they must act to alter the course of future by bringing themselves back into the natural law, bring themselves right back into harmony with our creation, and stop this headlong rush for somebody's willful dream of a utopia. Thomas More wrote about utopia in 1517. There's nothing new about the idea of a utopia. Aldous Huxley read Gomsky's writings. He wrote his Brave New World. Orwell read the writings of Shaw and the other Fabian socialists. He comes up with his, 1984. So there's nothing new about science fiction writers. There's nothing new about these kinds of utopian dreams. The reality is that we need to relax. We need to move towards these things. This will emerge out of society. We will have all of these things in due time. All questions will be asked and answered in time, but we're not to be pushed and rushed into this. And I believe firmly that's the great mistake, is the rush.
Well, it's their great mistake, and it's and for those of us who want to defend human life, defend the ideals of liberty and equal justice, it really presents a wonderful opportunity. Because had they continued at the pace they've been at for the last 100 years, who knows, it may have been very difficult for people ever to really wake up. But it's now coming after a lot of indoctrination over a long period of time that's been very effective. But it's coming very hard and very fast here towards the end. And people are seeing it. I just heard from all over the country this week the shock, and it comes from people from all political persuasions, the shock that it is now sanctioned that public-private partnerships can take your home if they've got to deal with the government folks. You know, so what we need to do with our government leaders is recognize that whether they're Democrat or Republican, they're all part of the sustainable party. They're just divisions of the same army that's marching against natural law and marching to the tune of their own power, legal positivism. And most of America, Democrat or Republican, Green or Libertarian, have no interest in that. And so it's time to split from those leaders and begin to recognize that we need to create the emergence of the real American movement that can be fired with all the energy of 1776 and more, because knowledge over the last 250 years has allowed our reason to even improve. And we can enter a positive era for humanity, but not when it's premised on the ideals of legal positivism. It has to be premised on the ideals of the natural law, on the realities of the natural law.
That's correct. A positive future, but without the mind-forged manacles that come with it.
Well, that's a necessity of living with the natural law. It's impossible to do that if you're living by the precepts of the natural law. Because that would recognize that mom and dad are mom and dad, you know, and that the state isn't there to undo mom and dad's values and virtues. You know, mom and dad take responsibility. They have the authority over their children, and they have the responsibility then to nurture and rear their children. And that's what comes natural to moms and to dads, too. And yet, we're handing our kids off, and we're paying $200,000 for college tuitions so that they get none of this information, but so that they're prepared and identified as the right chips for the cog in the New World Order, which will be a shrinking table and subject them, even who make the first cuts, to cuts in the second and third round, because you'll lose your own support for your own life. You're not making the determinations. A system now has taken over, and everyone's labeled, everyone's been judged, everyone's been categorized, and life runs accordingly. And that's not a pretty version of the life that any of us want to leave our children or their children or posterity generally. Because if we have one duty, as Mark Twain always said, it's the duty to ourselves. And that means the duty not to live in shame by perpetuating something that will destroy humanity's potential to be human.
That's right. That's right. And well stated. And this idea that I was holding as you were saying what you were saying brings forth something that I haven't heard very often. But there's a management process that I learned when I was starting in management many years ago, and that is it's threefold. First of all, we identify a need. Let's say you decide that you want to have a project done, and so you need to have someone to do the project. You decide you're too busy or it's more effective to have someone else. So you find a need, and then you select someone or you recruit for somebody, and that person comes forward. They then are given the responsibility. They step up to the plate for the responsibility. You give them the responsibility. Now, the second part is really important. Because I found myself time and time again when I was young being given plenty of responsibility, no doubt about that, but I was never given any authority. So when you give the responsibility away, someone stands up and they take the responsibility, then it is up to us to give that person the land, the authority to commit the land, the labor, and the capital necessary to accomplish that task. Beyond that, once they've got the responsibility under their hand, they've got the authority given to them. The next part, and this is the part that I see where we get the government we deserve, where we the people have fallen down in my lifetime, is that we forgot the third part, and that is accountability. We've given you the responsibility, Mr. President. We have given you the authority through the finances and everything else, and we the people will hold you accountable for the job that you signed up to do.
Well, I think you can take that right down to the county supervisors who are taking the sustainable money coming from the federal government, coming at the direction of the executive department, the last several executive administrations. But it is our local people. It's not so much the tax, I always say, that hurts us badly, as it is the receipt back of that tax money with the contracts and strings that attach that always take away our liberty step by step. And when you combine it then with the positive law and you look out at the landscape and you see the people who have assumed the responsibility for land, for instance, but they lose it because they're not given the authority to manage it. We're going to take a quick call from Roger in Pennsylvania. Thank you for calling, Roger. What is your commentary or question?
Yes, thank you. Very quickly, Robert Morey, author of Islamic Invasion, has been doing an excellent job speaking recently about many prominent theologians giving natural law theories, and I would say fallacies, preeminence over scripture. And just as a practical matter, you will find that where our founders used a phrase like the laws of nature and nature's God, that doesn't mean the same thing today, certainly, nor necessarily even back then. And you really can't get any kind of consensus as to what would constitute natural law. And God bless you all.
Well, you're absolutely right, Roger, and for part of this evening's presentation, I had purpose in my heart to go into the writings of Tom Paine and Thomas Jefferson and just look exactly at what they did mean when they said the natural law and the laws of nature and of nature's God. And it does not necessarily line up with an enforcement of a religion. William Penn, Philadelphia, stated that he was building the city of Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love, as a center for religious liberty. So coming from the European hegemony, I think that many people in America were looking for relief, and that the founders were very careful in the selection of their terminology so that they didn't lock in on one concept and lock out all others.
One thing we can certainly identify, all of us, and agree upon is that there are notions that come naturally to us as human beings, and that legal positivism, that is the guy who's got the law-writing pen, takes preeminence over all else, and that's the transition or transformation that's happening in America today. We've just got a couple of minutes, and this series for this month is concluded, but we're going to be having more discussions on subjects that relate and I look forward to that with great interest, because the notions that you've suggested stimulate people's minds and bring us closer. We're always chasing the final understanding of that truth, and that's the pursuit that life is all about. And clearly we're moving down the wrong path, and the ideas of looking at the natural law and hearing people who have been thinking and studying and working to bring this knowledge to a wider group of people. Well, this is the time for all good men to do such things, and I want to commend and thank you for your efforts and being on this show tonight, and wrapping up our series, The War on Reason, which we began 4 weeks ago with Dr. Michael Kaufman for 2 hours talking about how private property is being abolished in this country through the Wildlands Project. And of course, now we've seen the Supreme Court rule, and now we know that even the Supreme Court acknowledges that as the case. And then we talked with Dr. Karen Efren on children and the congressionally mandated mental health screening that three-year-olds are to go through starting very soon. And we talked to Dr. Edwin Vieira, who will be aired next week, on the money system. And we've had discussions about Fabian socialism and what's happening with the European Union and the people in Britain. And we've talked about a permanent revolution and the artificial dialectic and how sustainable development is really making itself operative. So it's been a great series, and I think this has been a great capstone to those discussions, because we get down really to the core, and that is, how do we organize our societies, and what are we ultimately respectful of as we do that? And do you have some just short final words that you might leave us with, Will?
All I can say is that in this battle, we need to succeed, and the natural law has a history of doing exactly that.
Well, we'll get down to the natural dialectic, which is the natural law versus legal positivism, and I think there is confidence that ultimately we win that, but what's important for the American people is that we do it with the least amount of pain, which means we need to get started now, because as the legal positives grow teeth, you know, it's going to be more difficult. So tune in next week for Greg Swank, who will come to us from Wisconsin and talk about victory against Agenda 21. Thank you for listening in tonight.